I know that I opened myself up for accusations of a lack of faith because I don't accept the doctrine so religiously held by some of American exceptionalism. I think that America is a wonderful country. I think that we have been a generous country and that we have, over a period of centuries, grown our sense of what it is to be free, what it is to be a human being, that we have expanded from beyond a very limited and limiting vision of what a human being was and what rights human beings had to a much broader and more universal sense of what the rights not of man are, and not of white men are, and not of white male property owners are, but of men and women of all races and all levels of in the socioeconomic scale. We are certainly not perfect. We are certainly a long way from any promised land. But we have had an ever-expanding sense of freedom and of liberty. But when we talk about, and particularly when conservatives talk about American exceptionalism and put it as an article of faith, if you deny American exceptionalism, you hate America, I find this nonsensical on so many levels and also offensive. The idea of exceptionalism is that the things that happen to other countries, to other nations, to other people, do not happen here, will not happen here, cannot happen here, because we have been so graced and so blessed that we're immune from the laws of nature and of history. That because we grew up in this splendid isolation between two shining seas, that all of the problems of the world, all of the patterns of the world, will not happen here. So our freedom and our democracy will always grow and will always expand. It's just inevitable. It's the way God graced us. I have had people tell me the same thing about the dot-com boom, the property balloon, and there are also some tulip futures in Holland, if you know your history. We're a great country. But all of the problems of anger, of class distinction, of poverty, of constant abridgments and attacks and pressures against freedom, liberty, and dignity also play out here as they do in the rest of the world. And to believe as an article of faith that it can't happen here is not to hate America. It is to have one's eyes open to the past so that we may be guided in the present towards a better future. It is not in giving up. It's not dissing America. It is saying, how do we protect ourselves? How do we protect each other? Unhealthy denial in almost any area of life is, of course, tautologically unhealthy. And to say that the issues of race cannot come back here in a toxic manner, the issues of class cannot divide us, the issues of poverty versus wealth cannot put a tear in the fabric of our society, all of these things is to ignore what happens in the world. And that seems to me to be not a very healthy thing to do. American history has expanded and has done really good things. But when we look at the process of history around the world, we see that there are always dangers. And as John F. Kennedy said, freedom, liberty, has to be re-won anew in every generation. We cannot, whatever our faith is, rely on God's constant grace, however you understand that particular phrase. What's interesting and to me ironic is that both liberals and conservatives who choose to use the language of grace are going to have one fundamental agreement, and that is its contingent nature. That grace once given doesn't necessarily abide forever if one is passive. Now, for conservatives, they say that God will remove his protective hand that saves America from all of those terrible things that happen in other lands if we do awful things like allow gay and lesbian marriage. Well, actually, they do approve of gays and lesbians marrying each other, but that's a whole other subject and not what we mean. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, after 9/11, talked about God put down his hands that protected America because of gays in South Beach in Florida and the absence of the Ten Commandments on the walls of schools. That's the God that they believe in. So they believe that grace has to be earned and can be lost. Well, I think the liberal perspective, when we use that kind of language, is also true. That the grace of what we have, what we celebrate, is something that is contingent. It is under constant attack. There are always people and forces and movements that want to stop the clock and turn the clock back and abridge freedoms that we thought had been definitively won. And from my viewpoint, we have to fight to maintain grace. It is not passive, and it is not simply about prayer and good fortune. It's about attentiveness. It's about being connected. It's about passion for expanding that and preserving a sense of freedom and of liberty, because it will not preserve itself. One of the greatest threats to our liberty and to our democracy actually comes from both sides. And it's the common view that, you know, it's already too late. There's no point to it. God is going to sweep in and the apocalypse is coming. And God is going to judge the sinners. And it's all over. There's nothing you can do but just wait to get either raptured or left here with all of the sinners and the party. That sounds okay, actually. But from the liberal perspective also, there is that cynicism, that despair that says, you know, it's already too late. The atmosphere is so polluted, we've passed the tipping point. The oceans are so dreadful. The fish are not simply being poisoned. They're crawling up on the land not to evolve, but just to end their misery. It's too late. Our democracy is gone. It's an oligarchy. The rich, the 1%, they've already eaten our lunch. They're going to devour our dinner, and they're going to consume our souls. Let's all just give up and roll over and die. Cynicism and despair are not good reactions to a crisis. Engagement doesn't make it a done deal. Passion doesn't mean that we're going to win, but it is a constant struggle, and if you believe it's all over, whether you're conservative or liberal, there's no good reason to get up in the world, and you leave the future to be written by somebody else. And so everyone, left, right, and center, has to ask, do I want tomorrow written by somebody that I consider to be so much more qualified than I am to engage and to work on this ever-living project called life? We have some history to guide us. When we look back at Greek philosophy, and I wish Dennis were here today because he'd correct me. When we look back at Greek philosophy, Plato and Aristotle both looked at methods of governance, of what were the strong points, what were the weak points, how could they evolve, how could they decay, what was the likely process. Now, Aristotle was kind of an elitist, and given his IQ, he probably had a right to be. He didn't much believe in the wisdom of the mob. He thought that thought and reason and education were really pretty important. And when he looked at democracy, first of all, we have to start with the fact that Athenian democracy has been somewhat romanticized. Athenian democracy, if not for the one percenters, it was for the 5% of the population of Athens. It was for the Greek male, native-born property owners. So if you were female, if you were not native-born, if you did not own property, you were not a part of that democracy. But even in that small exemplar, that little seed of what democracy might become, Aristotle looked at this and said, you know, I see two directions where this can go, because nothing is ever completely stable. One direction is a mobocracy. That is that the passions of the people can he didn't mean mafia-style mob, that's in the next category. But a mobocracy was the idea that the people have such passions, but not necessarily wisdom to govern those passions. That if you got a mob going, they would loot. And they could loot through the ballot box, through the initiative. They could loot through their power. They could loot society in many ways, because they were going to operate in their own narrow self-interest. And that's what happens with a mob. The word mob is related to the word mobile. And that is, it will roll in the various directions that it's pushed. It is subject not so much to reason as to passion. And the rule of the mob is one of the reasons that our founders in this country created a system of checks and balances, of dynamic tensions that valued deliberative contemplation and wisdom over speed. They designed this system, pardon the metaphor, to be constipated. They did not value efficiency and speed. They valued wisdom. Well, they got half of their desire. The constipation part is right there. The wisdom, not so much. But it's not a design flaw. It's an intentional part of the design to slow us down. Let's give a great example. After 9/11, people were pulled in a lot of directions, many hateful, many violent, often passionate. But we try to stop the mob. We try to stop the lynching party. There's never been a lynching party that didn't feel that it was justified in the moment. We ask reason and law to intervene with our impulses and say, just stop, let's wait a second. Maybe that's not such a great idea. That's part of how we try to guard against the mob taking over. But you can still see it happening. You can see at various political rallies people getting overexcited and awfully self-assured and arrogant and condescending. And there is always a movement left and right towards a mobocracy. The other direction that Aristotle saw democracy decaying in was oligarchy. That people and families would acquire wealth and power. And that even the other citizens who might qualify, who might be white, male, Athenian, white, male, Athenian property owners might not have a say, because great families, great enterprises might take over and rule, and without really listening to the people. That language that we use in today's society is about the 1% or the 2%, about the corporations that come together, that merge, and have an extraordinary amount of power. Societies are pulled in those two directions. Plato, coming before Aristotle and being his teacher, believed that leadership should be philosopher kings. Aristotle took on a gig. It was a pretty good paying gig, being the tutor to Aristotle. And he hoped to create a philosopher king. And Aristotle... I have to occasionally listen to what I say. He took on a gig as the tutor to Alexander the Great. And how did that work out? Well, Aristotle, after coaching Alexander to some degree of competency, if not excellence, ended his own life in exile in Sicily. So his belief in the philosopher king wasn't that kind of borne out by experience, which leaves us today with a democracy that is a living thing, in some ways a fragile thing, something that needs to be defended. We see infringements on it all of the time, both from right and left. We see mobs, and we also see the ability to control mobs by detention without warrants, snooping, eavesdropping, government hacking. The idea of indefinite detention of American citizens seems to me to be quite a horror, because what happens is governments and corporations decide that the most important value is their own preservation and not the preservation of their values, of our shared values. John F. Kennedy, again, asked the question during the Cold War, can we so fight to save America that we lose what America is about? And that's a rhetorical question, because the clear answer is yes, of course. Any country can, any group can, any individual can, when the corporate survival and interests go beyond the founding consensus of values. So when we would preserve and defend and protect our democracy, it can never be by any means necessary. It has to mean within values that we affirm. Democracy is worth fighting gently and firmly for. The battle is not over, and the battle will never be over. The cycle of histories inevitably turn, but while we, all of us here, are running our lap and this marathon that we hand off to the next generation, despair is not an option. Withdrawal is not a good faith option. Examining our values, as Socrates implored us to do, and living our values is how we create a more goodly nation. It's not as dramatic as revolution. It's not as easy as despair. But maintenance never is. But maintenance is what we do by being involved in the political system, by caring, by being informed, and by engaging passionately but humbly the great issues of the day, so that our democracy is guided by our values and we fight that decay with our intelligence and our lives.